Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM and WETS-HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Let me ask you a question. Do you like it when people take naked photographs of you? How about when they start feeling you up and touching all your private parts? Didn't think so. Why am I asking such strange questions? Well, if you think about it a moment, and especially if you travel on airplanes a lot, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about airport security. I'm talking about the friendly hands and friendly people of the Transportation Security Agency, or TSA. I think it's a safe bet that very few of us enjoy the process of going through airport security, from the long lines to the intrusive searches and all the rest of it. But some of us have made the claim from time to time that this actually violates our constitutional rights, and specifically our Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And that's not that far off base. I mean, these are government employees, and they are doing something that's awfully intrusive to us. But is there really a constitutional issue here? I'm going to speak with Kate Hanai, who is the executive director of a flyers rights group, and she has some definite opinions about this, which she'll share with us in just a moment. I'm also going to speak to a lawyer by the name of Engel, who has very different ideas. And though he shares some of Ms. Hanai's concerns, he doesn't think necessarily the Constitution is the way to resolve these conflicts. Let's start with our talk with Kate Hanai.
I'm the executive director of FlyersRights.org, the largest nonprofit airline passenger organization in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We have 50,000 members, and our goal is to restore the health, safety, well-being, and dignity of airline passengers through their entire air travel process.
That is a tall order. Of course, our focus in this show is the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
and the particular concern that I understand you have right now has to do with the constitutional right to privacy, and specifically how that might very well be violated by all of these new searches that are going on at airports. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, first of all, the way that TSA approached the flying public is that 100% of the flying public, regardless of cause, regardless of any kind of assessment of risk related to any human being coming through an airport, 100% of the flying public are going to be subjected to these body scanners and the pat-down.
Okay, before we go any further, let's talk specifically about these, because I'm sure all of us have heard to one extent or another about them. But I'd like to hear exactly what these machines do and why you find them objectionable.
Okay, great. So when we first took on this issue of the scanners, it was immediately after Abdulmutallab flew with the underpants bomb on that Delta flight. And Chertoff was all over the airways saying that these scanners would have found that bomb had they been used.
Was that the so-called Christmas bomber in Detroit?
Yes, the Christmas Day bomber in Detroit. The guy that was walked onto the aircraft without a passport, was seated over a gas tank, had no winter coat, had no bag, and was only going one way and paid cash for his ticket.
Ah.
Every red flag on the planet was there. He should have been stopped and never been on that flight, but he was.
Okay,
I can't help but be cynical about it.
Okay, so this guy with apparently a malfunctioning bomb in his underwear.
Right.
Focused people's attentions on this. And so how does that relate to these scanners?
Well, it benefits them, doesn't it? I mean, it parlayed a whole talking point for Michael Chertoff all over the airwaves to say, you know, first of all, the American flying public was scared. You know, they were afraid to get on planes, wondering if there were any more rogue bombers out there. And it actually was the reason that Chertoff used for implementation of the scanners and basically shoving the scanners down our throats and getting them implemented. He knew we were afraid. And so within 10 months, and I'm going to go through this chronologically for you so you understand how we ended up with these strip searches. Within 10 months, people were opting out of the scanners at record rates.
Okay, before we get to the chronology, and that's important, and I want to hear it, what exactly does this scanner do?
Okay.
What's
so
objectionable
what the scanner
about?
Does is it scatters radiation to within 1/10 inch of skin. So it doesn't go any deeper than 1/10 inch of skin. It looks for objects that are on top of your body. It cannot see anything deeper than 1/10 inch of skin. So if you have a cavity bomb or an implanted bomb or something behind, for a male, something behind their genitalia, or for a woman or a man in the folds of skin, it's not going to see it. But okay. It will detect metal, and it will detect hard-edged ceramics. So the one thing they do that I don't think the metal detector does is it will detect ceramics, although how many people take ceramics? It won't detect liquid slurries. It won't detect low-density powdered explosives on the body like PETN. So it actually would not have picked up Abdulmutallab's underpants bomb.
Okay, but what does it pick up? What makes it objectionable, the scanner?
What makes it objectionable is that it won't pick up anything deeper than 1/10 inch of skin. The TSA actually lied about the radiation, which they've now backtracked on their first statements about the amount of radiation that people are actually getting. They know now that it's 10 times higher than what they disclosed initially. And it violates people's privacy. People feel like they're exposing themselves, their children, their mothers, their wives, to some unknown, non-Megan's Law-screened TSA scanner in a back room, and they don't think that's right.
What sort of image does it produce?
Well, it produces 5 different images. Now, the one that they're saying they're displaying now out front by the scanner is sort of a stick figure, but the guy in the back room who's looking at the image in the back room has the ability to flip between 5 different scans. And there also is a USB port that came attached to these machines, so the scans could be transmitted or saved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I learned through EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Group, when we did our symposium last mm-hmm. year. And there have been, by the way, there have been images found in a warehouse in Florida, about 25,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that they are being saved. We don't know
what do they look like?
Aware.
I mean, is this a fairly close representation of what we look like in our birthday suits?
Oh, it is an exact representation.
Mm-hmm. So that's really what it comes down to probably for most people is it looks like someone's taken a naked picture of you.
That's correct. And when you think about it, the truth of the matter is that they really have to be able to see that level of definition to pick up irregularities like explosives, if that's what they're really doing in the back room. And I've witnessed what it looks like on those 5 different screens in that back room, and they have a magnifying glass, so they can actually go over your image with, zooming in on all parts of your body and really get a close-up look at it to establish whether or not you've got something that is dangerous on your person.
Well,
at that point, if they see it, then they send you for an additional pat-down.
This is sounding kind of like passenger porn.
It is passenger porn.
Uh-huh. Or it could be, in the wrong hands and in the wrong, people were using it for the wrong purposes.
Oh, absolutely. It's very funny because I got a call when this discussion became very heated was right about the time that Tiger Woods' exploitations were revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a call from a couple of those sensational TMZ journal and a couple of like Star magazine, and they said to me, if you get any reports of any movie star scans showing up, call us.
Oh, for heaven's sake, really?
Because they were ready to pay for them.
Oh, I bet they would. Oh,
yep.
I bet they would. Now, you know what this reminds me of, Kate, is I don't know if you ever read Dick Cavett's column in the New York Times.
No, I don't.
You may want to Google it. He's written extensively about a rather strange study that was done in many Ivy League colleges back in the 50s and 60s, where supposedly they were studying the posture of young people. Supposedly there was some scientific reason for this, and what it meant in practical terms is that they would simply have cattle calls for the incoming freshmen, both women and men, at these various schools, and they would make them get photographed in the nude.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yes. It's been written about several times over the past couple of decades, but it's still not maybe that well known. And so there are just these troves of pictures that could still be out there, though many of these colleges claim that they've destroyed them. There actually are some apparently stored at the National Archives, just a bunch of naked young people, many of whom would probably be movie stars or other prominent people.
Wow.
And so you may simply find that an interesting thing to look into, but that's what this reminds me of. I mean, if TMZ or whatever other sensationalistic show wants to get naked pictures of celebrities, I guess that would make sense that they would try to get their hands on these scans if they could.
That's right. Oh, yes. And you know, the TSA agents are certainly not upstanding people. As we have found out, we've had several TSA agents arrested for being pedophiles. About 17% of all theft that happens from baggage happens by TSA agents.
Hmm.
It's kind of a rogue organization, and that also makes, you know, people like me very uncomfortable.
Are there any circumstances where we've seen that some TSA agent has improperly used any of these scans?
No. Not that we're aware of yet.
Mm-hmm.
We've had our eyes and ears open for this for a long time, but we haven't seen it happen yet. But
okay.
they claim to not know who we are, but you know they do.
Hmm.
I mean, what use would the scans be if they don't know who you are?
Well, here's an interesting... Let me play devil's advocate with you, though.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand, certainly, nobody necessarily wants to be photographed naked unless somebody's willing to pay them an awful lot of money for it. And nobody necessarily wants any sort of intrusion of this sort, and maybe people don't want the extra radiation or any of the other objectionable things you've identified. But isn't this necessary if we're going to protect people in this era of terrorism in the air?
Well, security, real security is necessary, but this isn't real security. There's never been a terrorist one time caught at a TSA checkpoint. Every single terrorist has made it on a plane, and the flight attendants and the passengers have been the first line of defense.
Hmm.
I mean, case in point. You know, and if you think about it, and let me just tell you what really goes on at the airport. The ground workers aren't screened when they come to work, so what's to prevent a ground worker from being sullied and from, you know, taking a bomb onto a plane? You know, they found tasers on planes, they found bullet holes in planes, and all this just within the last 6 months. You know, so there's one issue. The vendors that go into an airport, they go through security and they're not screened. So they go in and take their products in the middle of the night to stock up all of the airport stores and restaurants, and they're not screened. There are myriad ways where TSA, their agents are not screened. So there are myriad ways of getting a bomb or a weapon inside an airport for a terrorist to go clean through security and just pick that up in a hidden location or even in a store if it was specially marked and create their bomb and get on a plane and that's the end.
Mm-hmm.
If you know, luckily there aren't that many bombers out there, your chance of actually being on a plane with a terrorist is almost nothing. But, you know, the truth of the matter is the government knows and most passengers know that these TSA checkpoints are completely ineffective. Now, those aren't the only things that TSA do, but one of my arguments about the way that they've approached security has been, you know, they still don't screen 100% of the U.S. mail that flies in the belly of passenger aircraft that weighs less than 1 pound. And you could have a bomb that weighs less than 1 pound that would take down a jet. So with them, you know, making these kinds of decisions and treating 100% of the passengers that come to an airport as if they are a terrorist, the assumption is that we're all a risk. And yet they've never caught a terrorist at a checkpoint. Should we not retool TSA altogether?
What would you have them do instead of these sorts of... scans?
I would have them become trained like they do in Israel to detect behavior, looking for bombers, not bombs. It's a simplistic way of saying it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Fly Clear program and Global Entry, which is still in effect for international travelers, does that. They do a background check, you give an iris scan and you give fingerprints, and then you have a large group of low-risk travelers that can move quickly and efficiently through the TSA checkpoint, and then the TSA's focus can be on those who actually present some kind of a risk. And they should be trained to identify those folks. Atta, Mohammed Atta, was on a list. And he still got on a plane with a box-cutting knife and you know, took a plane into the World Trade Center.
Right. Atta was one of the 9/11 bombers, if I recall correctly, on the airplanes. And he was also, in fact, I think he was typically identified as the leader of the group, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we also need to talk about another variation on this, and that is the so-called strip search. Now, when do strip searches happen?
Well, the TSA denies that they happen, but they happen every day. And let me tell you why these searches were implemented. I was getting to that a minute ago when I was talking about the chronology of this. What TSA realized was that their diabolical plan to implement all of these scanners by the end of 2011 was at risk because people were opting out in droves. They did not want to be naked body scanned. We helped spread the word through the media about how unhappy and how about 15% of our members decided they just won't fly anymore as long as they had to face those scanners.
Mm-hmm.
So the travel industry has been really hurt by the implementation of these procedures. So DHS and TSA, in their infinite wisdom, decided that they would introduce the full Monty genital breast pat-down and these strip searches in order to force people into the scanners.
Okay, so right now, if I go through the airline, and I've done this a few times over the last few years, and they route you through the scanner, and I've simply gone through the scanners. But if I had opted out of going through the scanner, then I would have been shunted off to the side, and then what would have happened to me?
And then, depending on your condition, you would be given a pat-down, but they will ask you if you have any rods in you, any metal implanted in you, or if you have any medical devices. That's where we see the strip searches. And when
so if I had a bum knee, or if I had some screws in my jaw or someplace else from surgery I'd had, then I would get greater scrutiny?
Yes.
Okay.
You would, depending on the location of your implanted metal, like if it was in your knee, they would have you drop your trousers.
Mm-hmm.
And not in front of everyone. They take you in a private room. But they don't videotape them. And most people don't know that they can have a witness go with them in that room,
mm-hmm.
a witness of their choice. And so it's been the TSA's word against the traveler about what actually happens during these searches, which is why you saw TSA denying that they happened in New York,
mm-hmm.
and yet you had several elderly women claim that they were strip searched, and they were. We know that TSA will reach their hands inside folks' pants whenever there's some kind of a urostomy or colostomy bag, and they will swab those areas. They do it with gloves on, but they will often swab those areas to see if there's any explosives. They're not trained medically to handle these medical devices, so you hear about, like, Tom Sawyer twice having his urostomy bag dislodged and urine running down his leg. These are the kinds of stories that we hear almost daily.
And so you're trying to get the word out to people that they can bring witnesses in.
Yes, they not only that, but on our website we have a TSA card that people can print out, and they can write on this card what type of medical device they have and how the device has to be handled. Some folks actually take, when they have metal implanted in them, they take copies of their X-rays, and it's really hit and miss, but sometimes that prevents them from having to have a strip search.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Kate Hanai about all those nasty things the TSA does to us at airport security lines. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and we'll come back and speak some more with Kate Hanai. Stick around.
He touched me. He put his hand near mine, and then he touched me. I felt a sudden tingle when he touched me. A sparkle, a glow.
Well, we're here on yet another beautiful, fine spring day at James Madison's Montpelier, and with us is...
Jim.
Jim, where are you from?
Grundy, Virginia.
You're from Grundy, Virginia?
Right. Uh-oh. Did you bring a ringer?
I don't. We'll have to wait and see, won't we? Okay. I just saw this guy. He's wearing a Yale hat. He looks like he might be a smart guy. We'll see. Okay, Kelly, what is the quiz we have for Jim today?
All right. Well, on this fine, beautiful day at James Madison's Montpelier, I've got a question for you about the Philadelphia Convention. All right. At the start of the Philadelphia Convention, the delegates agreed to A, follow the instructions of Congress, B, improve the Articles of Confederation, C, give the state governments more power, or D, write a new constitution.
D.
Oh, are you sure?
I'm sure.
What, do you want to even discuss the other choices?
I think it was pretty plain what they were there for.
But I thought they were there to talk about the Articles, improve the Articles of Confederation,
well,
were they not?
The result was more than that.
Well, wait, what was the actual question?
At the start of the Philadelphia Convention, the delegates agreed to do
okay,
what?
So it's something they agreed to do rather than what they were there yep. originally for. And so
I suppose it is possible they wasted a little time trying to tweak the Articles of Confederation and then decided it was hopeless and changed course. But I'm inclined to believe that they knew that it wouldn't work when they got there and started work on a new structure from the very beginning.
Well, what do you say, Kelly?
Well, I had one follow-up question. Who was helping lead the charge in this?
Well, I think that Madison's presentation of the Virginia plan on the first day is pretty hit.
This guy sounds maybe like he knows what he's talking about.
He does.
Okay, so was he right?
He is right. Congratulations.
Jim, congratulations. That's marvelous. And you get exactly right for exactly the right reasons. And now let's reveal your full identity. Who are you?
I am James Bowers. I'm a professor at the same school that employs our moderator.
Exactly right. Jim Bowers is one of our newer faculty hires. He's come here just in the last year. He is the spouse of our new dean, Lucy McHugh. And Jim and I actually drove out to Montpelier together today. But it is coincidence. We happened to see Jim come up, and he's enjoying his lunch. So we decided to interrupt you, Jim. Thank you for letting us interrupt you.
Well, you're entirely welcome.
Have you enjoyed your visit here to Montpelier?
So far, it's been fascinating.
Tremendous.
It's a terrific place.
Isn't it? And
it
you
is.
Picked a pretty day for it, too.
It couldn't be better.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. We're talking with Kate Hanai about airport searches and airport security procedures. And it's safe to say that Kate doesn't like them much, and I'm guessing most of you don't like them much either. But that's not the question for us. The question for us is, do these procedures violate the Constitution? From a constitutional viewpoint, again, to play devil's advocate, the argument would be that nobody has to go through a scan or a strip search, that this is all voluntary, that people have agreed to it because they have chosen to fly. And they don't have, no one's going to make you fly. How do you respond when people make that argument?
Well, because it's not so much a choice for a business traveler. If your company tells you you have to go from A to B, and the primary people screaming about this were our members, especially small business owners that have to fly to their meetings, where they can't do a GoToMeetings or a Skype call, mm-hmm. and they must be wherever it is they need to go for business, they don't have a choice, just like a pilot or a flight attendant doesn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. The pilots and the flight attendants were able, through a great deal of media attention on the issue, to get biometric scan cards, and now they don't have to go through the scanners or the pat-downs. But to this day, law enforcement officials, Department of Defense, even people with pretty high-level security, congressmen that don't have a security detail, they all have to go through the exact same things that a potential terrorist would be subjected to going through a checkpoint. And I think it's ridiculous because we are not all the same. You know, the thing is all human beings are not created equal. And if the TSA can't figure out how to distinguish between someone who's a risk and someone who's just an airline passenger who brings no risk, zero risk to the table. These 85-year-old women brought zero risk to the table.
But isn't there a danger if we emphasize, as you say, finding the bombers and not the bombs, and if we emphasize eliminating people who are low risk, are we putting ourselves in a position where the TSA is now going to have to defend itself against accusations that it's doing racial profiling? I mean, are young, dark-skinned men going to get strip-searched every time while the rest of us, sail through security?
Well, I don't think so, because once you get familiar with the TSA's actual background, they already have a list of countries, if Nigeria being one of them, that they are going to give a second look to those folks that have passports from those countries.
Mm-hmm.
So there are going to be certain people from certain countries who are going to get a second look regardless, and they should, because, you know, there are countries where terrorism is rampant. And where they've actually, you know, that's where Abdulmutallab was coming from, was Nigeria. So, I think that there is a risk of people perceiving the word profiling as being racial profiling, but it's not. I'm talking about behavioral profiling, which they use in Israel very successfully. They have a 100% success rate. They do facial imaging at the airports there, where they try to match facial features of passengers with known terrorists. I don't think that would be one bit objectionable to anyone who wasn't a terrorist.
Very interesting. Well, we've talked a long time, Kate, so any final thoughts before we conclude this?
My final thought is this. If people are upset about this and they feel that their constitutional rights are being violated, then they need to file complaints with their congressman, not with TSA so much. TSA will never make public these complaints that they get. They won't talk about them or even the number of people that have actually complained. They've stonewalled us with every request, but they need to let their congressmen and senators know how they feel about this, because without, you know, we need to stop the appropriation of funds to DHS and TSA towards these scanners and implementation of these pat-downs in order to make a change, because clearly the government's not changing their behavior.
Well, wasn't that a fascinating interview with Kate Hanai, an advocate for the rights of the flying public all over our great nation, all over the world, perhaps? Now let's have a different perspective on these airport security procedures. Let's speak to an attorney who's actually studied this subject to some extent, and maybe he's come to a little bit different conclusions that Kate has. His name is Adam Engel.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, tell me, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I am currently working as a criminal defense lawyer in Ohio. I'm also vice president and general counsel for a security consulting and investigations company composed of former law enforcement officers. Prior to that, I worked as a prosecutor both in Massachusetts and Ohio for about 7 years. And then I also worked for the state of Ohio dealing with security, law enforcement, and public safety issues.
I see. Well, it sounds like you're someone who knows a little bit about airport security, and I understand that you have some thoughts to express with regard to whether these somewhat intrusive searches we all endure at the airport violate any of our constitutional rights.
That's right. My view is that while the searches can be annoying and people sometimes feel that they aren't accomplishing much, they do not violate the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution.
Okay, well, now the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures of our persons, among other things. Don't you feel like when someone is feeling us up at the airport or taking pictures of us that give rather detailed pictures of our naked bodies, you don't think those are unreasonable?
Well, the key question or the key word in there is unreasonable searches and seizures.
Mm-hmm.
The Constitution does not prohibit every single search and seizure. And when you're talking about a search conducted by the TSA, you're talking about something called an administrative search. An administrative search is a search whose primary goal is not to detect crime, but to protect the public. You can contrast that to the common search we think of, where the police are going into someone's house or going to search someone's car. There, they're looking for evidence of a crime. When you talk about the TSA, they're more like checkpoints or other goals aimed at public safety. And that becomes a big difference, because when you're comparing an administrative search to the rights of the person, you have to take into account both the governmental interest and the intrusion on a person's privacy. In this case, you have a very significant governmental interest, and it's not even speculative. We've known for years and years and years that people will use airplanes to try to hurt people and use it for political purposes. 9/11 was only the most recent example, but people have been hijacking airplanes or blowing up airplanes for years and years and years. So the question isn't, can the government do this? The government certainly has a role, I would suggest, to do this. The real question becomes, is the government doing anything that is more intrusive than necessary? And really, despite people wording it saying that they're being felt up or having naked photos taken of them, the history of the TSA and the history of security is that these are not more intrusive than necessary, and that they serve an important governmental interest.
Well, they might serve an important governmental interest, but on the other hand, of course, they really are rather intrusive. Maybe it's a male-female thing. I know that I personally don't object too much when somebody's putting his hands on me. It's just not something I find particularly objectionable, but I know that my wife and most women I speak to feel very, very differently about it. So is it a matter of being a matter of the beholder or the victim, if you will, of the search?
Well, anytime you're talking about a search, you're going to be talking about a reasonable person. And would a reasonable person think that this is too intrusive? I think you would have a different situation, for example, if you required people to conduct or be subjected to a strip search. Mm-hmm. If you're subjected to a strip search, that seems to be more than is necessary to protect the security of airplanes and airports and people on the ground who've been injured by airplanes. In this case, the TSA, it appears they do a lot of work and they rely on a lot of intelligence about how people can hide weapons or instruments that they can use to harm people. And so when you're conducting these searches, they're not conducted for I'm trying to think of the right phrase. They're not conducted for the purpose of harassing people, or they're not even conducted to find evidence. They're conducted because that there's a belief that weapons or something could be hidden in those areas.
Okay, so as objectionable as a woman might find it if a TSA person puts his hands under or around her breasts, or any of us might feel if we get felt up in our between our legs or rear ends or wherever, those are places, apparently, where terrorists might very well decide to hide a bomb or hide a weapon. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And what we're really talking about is, and why I've often described this as sort of a silly season, is turning a policy debate into a constitutional law debate. The question is not, does the Constitution, I would suggest, prohibit these types of searches? The Constitution gives the government large amounts of latitude in these types of administrative searches, so long as they are accomplishing a legitimate governmental interest and they are reasonably designed to accomplish that interest. But what this really is, and what I suggest you're suggesting, is a policy debate. And there is a good policy debate to be had out there about whether the types of searches are effective, whether there are other types of searches that can be done, whether the TSA rules are necessary to accomplish that goal, and whether they sufficiently protect privacy. But that's a separate issue, I'd suggest, than the constitutional issue. Let me give you an example. The TSA has been criticized, and I suggest probably rightly so, for their rules not allowing people to use cell phones on an airplane, mm-hmm. and or to use their computers during takeoff, taxi, and landing. At the same time, they allow pilots to use iPads in the cockpit. suggesting that there really isn't much of a safety threat to these devices. The point is that this is a policy issue, and this is a discussion that should be had and should be had openly. But it's not necessarily a constitutional issue that happened.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Speaking about the efficacy of these searches, one of the points that the people who object to the searches will make, they'll say, we've never caught any terrorist at a TSA checkpoint, therefore those checkpoints are ineffective. How do you respond to that?
I think proving a negative is always very difficult. Yes, as far as I know, we haven't caught a terrorist doing these things, but we're reacting to what terrorists have done. It comes to my mind that people take off their shoes now, and we did that after someone tried to hide a bomb or explosives within his shoe, and it has a huge deterrent effect. So people know they can't bring weapons onto airplanes. When I do security consulting work, and our folks advise companies on their security, one of the things we always talk about is having a hardened target, something that you make it difficult for them to do. So if you've increased airport security and you've increased the TSA scrutiny of people as they come in, then terrorists are going to have to find another target. They won't be able to use airplanes like they used them before.
So in other words, it's sort of like building a wall. People will no longer go where the wall is. They'll have to go around it. And you're sort of directing or deflecting the threat into other avenues.
That's right. Although I hate to say deflecting it into other avenues, because if we have enough security everywhere, then you completely get rid of the threat.
Well, I guess maybe the better analogy is plugging holes. I mean, let's say there are six different ways a terrorist can get onto a plane, and one of them is to walk through the front gate. And so you've blocked that gate off. And then you try to block the other holes as best you can.
That might be a good analogy. I mean, we take steps to make sure terrorists can't shoot down airplanes with missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do that. If you think about a neighborhood, if every neighborhood, a neighbor in the neighborhood has a security system, then the crook is going to have to go to a different neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
If only half the houses have security systems, then probably the crook is going to go after the houses that don't have those security systems.
Good.
But because a house isn't broken into, you can't say, well, the security system hasn't stopped anyone from breaking in. They're just going to someone else's house who doesn't have the security system.
One issue that has come up, we haven't discussed yet, and it goes back to the constitutional issue, is the issue of consent. People on your side of the issue have said from time to time, well, of course, there's no Fourth Amendment issue here because people don't have to fly, and implicitly at least, when they decide they will fly, they are agreeing to whatever regulations apply. And so just like any other constitutional right, the Fourth Amendment right can be waived.
I have two thoughts about that.
Mm-hmm.
The first is I personally have never been real comfortable with that idea because air travel is really a part of modern life.
That's so interesting, Adam. I thought you were going to jump on that, Artie. You were arguing this side. I thought you were going to say, oh, yes, of course, but that's not what you rely upon.
No, that really isn't. I know some people do, and I know some courts have mentioned this, and it becomes especially important, and we could talk about it in a moment, the issue of customs searches. But at least in terms of air travel, on the one hand, it is correct. People consent to travel, and people are pretty well aware of what TSA procedures are. On the other hand, air travel is really a part of modern life, and if you exclude someone from air travel, you really are excluding them from taking part in a large part of the economy. More importantly, though, I feel always a hesitation when the TSA or folks rely on this idea of consent because the TSA doesn't tell us a lot of what they do. They keep a lot of what they're looking for and a lot of their procedures completely secret. And in fact, how much they're going to search someone completely secret. And well, they should because you don't want to give terrorists a guide to how to get through the policies. But to the extent that people don't know how intrusive a search they're going to be subjected to, it's harder to suggest that they have consented to that search completely. I think the better idea is to hold them to the standard which I think they meet, which is that they have to conduct searches that are reasonably related to a specific threat.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're discussing airport security procedures with attorney Adam Engel, and whether these procedures violate our Fourth Amendment rights. After the break, we'll find out what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll finish our discussion with Adam Engel. Stick around. Well, Kelly, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, we still have some spaces left in a couple of our upcoming summer seminars for educators.
Summer seminars,
yes.
That's right. Okay, we've already talked about the first one. That was the We the People one, right?
Yeah, but there's a couple other interesting ones, in particular the one on the War of 1812, America's Second War of Independence.
Right. Now, why would Montpelier be specifically interested in the War of 1812? I wonder.
James Madison may have had something.
You may have had something
some role to do with it. Yeah.
In fact, we refer to that war as Mr. Madison's War here, don't we?
Yeah. So the seminar is going to focus on War of 1812 and James Madison and related constitutional issues, all from James and Dolly Madison's home.
Wow.
And it's in July, so there's still time to plan, July 15th through the 19th, and you can apply online at montpelier.org.
And this is a residential program.
It is a residential program. And actually, one of the days we will depart Montpelier and we'll head up to Washington, D.C. and do some tours and talk about some of the relevant sites in Washington, D.C. With regards to the War of 1812.
So there's a field trip.
There's a field trip.
Now, was there any charge?
We get on a bus and the wheels go round and round.
I've heard that song, too. I'm sure all the teachers have, too. So is there any charge for a teacher to attend this?
It's free. Once you're accepted, there is a $50 registration fee, but that's it. Everything, room and board and everything.
So basically, you pay the registration fee, you get yourself to Montpelier, and then you have what essentially is a developmental vacation.
Yes.
Tremendous. That's absolutely wonderful, and I wish I could go. But absolutely. And once again, montpelier.org to register.
Exactly.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris.
Pulled me out of the line, threatened a fine if I wouldn't go through their machine.
You mean they
got knocked out?
I thought it would be naughty to let them scan my body. So out of that I opted, then they got me. Now all I want to know is, can I go? They felt me up, then they felt more.
More, more, more!
Grubba, 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 grope me. Airport security. Nappy, jammy, then grab me. Make me miss my flight.
We're discussing airport security procedures and whether they're constitutional with attorney Adam Engel. Let's finish our conversation. Any other thoughts on these administrative searches that the TSA is doing?
Well, one of the questions out there that I think they're struggling with is how far those searches are going to extend into containers and into people's cell phones and computers.
In some cases, let's talk about that. That's a huge issue.
It's a very difficult issue because right now, at least when you come through customs, people have been charged with crimes because of things found by TSA agents or found by custom agents. And typically it comes up in the a less sympathetic world of child pornography. There's been cases where a TSA agent found a stack of documents or stack of papers and leafed through those papers just to make sure there wasn't anything bad in there and notice that there is child pornography. And the court seemed to express some discomfort with that. But again, as long as the TSA agent was able to articulate that the search that they were doing was looking for something that might be a threat to the airplane, then that search is probably permissible under the Constitution. The next leap, though, is going to be, what if they need to search the contents of, say, a cell phone? Not just to make sure a cell phone isn't concealing a weapon in it, but suppose they believe that a person has emails on that cell phone leading to or discussing a possible terrorist attack. Can the TSA then start searching that cell phone as the person goes through security? There seems to be some suggestion that they could, that, you know, the cell phone is nothing more than a container, and the information in it is the same as the clothes in your suitcase.
Oh, boy, that's a much tougher issue. I mean, I could make the argument for the TSA that if they really think they've got a terrorist who's part of a larger plot right in front of them, then by golly, yes. I mean, if there's an imminent bombing that's about to happen or an imminent attack, then they want to very quickly, as an exigent circumstance, figure out who that person's been texting with over the last 24 hours. I can make that argument, but on the other hand, if they just happen to get mom or pop who's raised their suspicion for something, and all of a sudden they're looking through all of mom and pop's personal correspondence, that's tougher.
Well, now, you're talking about two very different scenarios, because mm-hmm. if the TSA has individualized suspicion about a person, mm-hmm. and part of what they are doing now, according to reports, is trying to develop better ways to figure out which individuals are potential threats and which individuals aren't. That's why you see, you know, for example, TSA agents doing what they do often in Israel, which is engaging folks in conversation to try to develop whether this person is engaging in some suspicious behavior that allows the TSA to conduct a further search. Once you develop that individualized suspicion, you're in a different Fourth Amendment world. Now you're talking about whether one of those circumstances, like you described, exigent circumstances, arise, or there's some other reason under the Fourth Amendment you can do it. The other issue, the more difficult issue, is can they do this as part of their administrative screening? Can they say, you know, when you turn on your computer to make sure it's actually a working computer, can we look through your emails anyway? That may be a bridge too far.
The first one's much easier to justify. Of course, they'd have to be careful and really justify it. But it all goes back to this core idea that they're trying to protect people right there, right now. And that's one thing, but simply at some point coming across something or looking too broadly, going on a bigger fishing expedition, that's when the Fourth Amendment issues crop up, I think.
That's right. That's when it starts to become unreasonable.
Right.
When the TSA is starting to search for things that are unrelated to their mission of protecting air travel.
Right.
And if they're going to become customs agents and look for contraband coming on the airplanes or coming into the country or leaving the country, if they're going to look for child pornography, if they're going to look for those types of items, then they're moving well beyond their core mission, and they would have less deference. And if you ask me, I think they'd be entitled to much less deference. But my view is, in getting back to your question, as long as they are geared towards that core mission of protecting air travel and protecting the public, they're going to be okay on Fourth Amendment grounds. And if they happen to stumble across some illegal material while they're conducting those searches, the Fourth Amendment still isn't implicated. Those materials could be used to prosecute someone.
Yeah, sort of inevitable discovery thing or plain view sort of argument. You know, they're not looking for it. They've got a justification for being there, but they happen across it, and certainly as law enforcement officers, they can, at that point, report it or seize it.
Yeah, and then at some point, the Fourth Amendment might require them to then, you know, hold on to it and get a search warrant before conducting further searches.
Right.
But they would have enough information based on what they legally found through their administrative search to justify that search warrant.
Understood. Well, another thing you've been mentioning here, and it goes back to your core argument that these searches are reasonable because they are based upon, the science, the research, the possibility that there is, a weapon or some other dangerous object being hidden on a person's body. One thing you mentioned was that they're getting better at identifying terrorists, and of course that brings up a related issue, and that is, of course, profiling, and especially racial profiling. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, what they need to do in order to not run across or run afoul of the Constitution is make sure that their profiling is not based on illegal factors such as race. And what they've gotten good at and are getting much better at, I believe, is behavioral detection. Mm-hmm. Noticing certain things that people will do as they're waiting in line, as they are interacting with agents, as they are interacting with fellow travelers, that these behavioral things can give them clues about people who probably should have a greater level of scrutiny. That's very different than racial profiling or something else that would raise constitutional concerns.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me play devil's advocate. I mean, if I were TSA and I were accused of racial profiling because I had pulled aside a disproportionate number of people from the Middle East, for example, the argument I would raise in my defense, if I were representing the TSA, was that the vast majority of people who have launched attacks on American airliners have been from the Middle East. Shouldn't we take that into account? Do you think that that sort of argument has any sort of validity?
No, I don't think it does. And the reason I don't think it does is because even assuming your postulate is true, that the vast majority of terrorists who pose a threat to the country are of Middle Eastern.
Oh, no. So it's simply the ones that have been caught thus far. I mean,
And there's two problems with it. One, I think it's factually incorrect. It appears, in many ways the greatest security threats we have now are from homegrown terrorists who wouldn't fit that profile. But even if you thought that profile were true, mm-hmm. you're still talking about a very low percentage of people within that community. Too low, I would suggest, or which you could draw good conclusions. This is something that we're in law enforcement, we're very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
The officers are trained very early on when they pull people over and they decide they want to conduct further search or further inquiry, let's say at a traffic stop on the side of the highway,
mm-hmm.
They're trained very early on not to use those illegal factors, racial factors, in making those determinations, but instead are trained to rely on behavioral clues, things that they see. And it's easier to think about in a traffic stop and the stuff isn't classified as well. If you see someone, for example, you pull them over, you look for, are they trying to hide something in the bottom of the car? Do they appear nervous? Are they giving you indicators that they might be intoxicated? These are all physical and behavioral things that you can look for that are independent from race.
Okay. So, again, we go back to the idea that if they have a reasonable basis for believing that a particular part of the body is a place where something can be hidden, then they can search it. If they have a factual basis for thinking that certain behavioral patterns indicate that this person deserves more scrutiny than the next, that's also reasonable as well. Anything else that would justify what the TSA is doing now?
One other thing that the TSA is looking at, and again, I'm judging this from reports, is history of people,
mm-hmm.
and looking up, comparing passengers, perhaps even to criminal records or to other intelligence that the agencies might have. And so you're using facts about a person's history to determine whether they might pose a greater risk and therefore should be subject to greater scrutiny. Those also, I don't believe, raise significant Fourth Amendment concerns, because as long as you're doing so in a non-racial and non-biased way.
Okay. Well, I see we're getting close to being out of time, Adam. So do you have any final thoughts about TSA searches before we finish up?
Well, I think one of the things that we discovered in doing this, and it's become a little quieter now, is that TSA searches and the TSA gathers a lot of attention and people sometimes we think are trying to make points about TSA searches, perhaps to get some attention rather than to make the really difficult and at times subtle policy points about the type of search we need. You know, what I'm trying to do is make sure that the discussion focuses on those real policy issues, whether we are providing the right amount of resources to protect air travel, or perhaps we're providing too many resources to protect air travel, or perhaps we're having not enough. But those are real and hard discussions that we need to have. And so long as people are, you know, wearing underwear like we've seen with metallic ink with the Fourth Amendment, or there was a young gentleman recently in a case who took off his shirt and had the Fourth Amendment written on his chest in magic marker.
Mm-hmm.
They think they're making a point, I suggest, but they're not really. They're distracting us from what's a really difficult issue, and at the end of the day, I'd suggest is not necessarily a constitutional issue, but instead is a resources allocation issue, is an intelligence issue, is a privacy, and can become a privacy issue if the TSA is not protecting this information adequately. But that doesn't convert it, even if people feel uncomfortable, to a Fourth Amendment issue.
All right, last question. When you personally travel, do you go through the scanner or do you get frisked?
I go through the scanner. I don't mind going through the scanner. But they haven't asked to frisk me yet. My 3-year-old daughter loves to go through that scanner and stand up there with her arms over her head. So, I don't know what that says about the procedures at all, but she thinks that's just the neatest thing in the world.
That does feel a little futuristic, doesn't it? Well, Adam Engel, I very much appreciate you coming on and speaking to us about the Fourth Amendment and TSA searches. Thank you for being on your weekly Constitutional.
Well, thank you for having me.
Things are getting very tense at airline security checkpoints across the country, and that would be an interesting.
Boy, are they ever.
Yeah, get this. A confrontation between a California man and TSA officials in San Diego has gone viral this morning. 31-year-old software engineer John Tyner was going on a hunting trip with his father-in-law on Saturday. He refused that full body scan, and then he turned his cell phone video camera on, recording this exchange with security agents.
Also, we're going to be doing a groin check. That means I'm going to place my hand on your hip, the other hand on your inner thigh, slowly go up and slide down.
Okay.
I'm going to do that 2 times in the front and 2 times in the back.
All right.
And if you'd like to grab a screening, we can make that available for you also.
We can do that out here, but if you touch my junk, I'm going to have you arrested.
Sing a song of pat downs, going to feel me up again. I've been traveling from airport to airport, and every time I get groped again, feel my ass, it might have a bomb, feel my front side too. You know what might be hiding there, maybe a whole damn zoo. Pat me down with a serious frown, and I know you got a job to do. Your hands up along my manscape, let me know.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Adam Engel and to Kate Hanai, who talked about airport security procedures and whether or not they violate the Constitution. I think whether they violate the Constitution or not is important, but they certainly violate me. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.
Don't touch my junk, Mister, I love America too. But if your big hairy hand goes up my ass, then I'll have a bone to pick with you.